Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst. From swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean, these experiences are unparalleled in their historical relevance and grandeur. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to preserve the past to inspire future generations of dreamers. This is accomplished through the youth education program focused on deserving junior high students across California. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, one of the most awe-inspiring locations in the world. The legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture, is woven into the foundation at Hearst Castle's mission. Julia Morgan's life can continue to inspire and empower young women and young men all over the world. This is one of the few opportunities to donate to such an important cause that not only changes the lives and perspectives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors. Please go to the website, foundation@hearstcastle.com, to learn more about how you can help us with our important mission.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from southern Indiana. Come along and join distiller Alan Reed Bishop at the French Lick Distillery in West Baton Springs, Indiana. Bishop shares his passion for Indiana's pre-Prohibition history, combined with a love of the science behind crafting exotic botanical spirits, bourbon, apple brandy, and American whiskey. Bishop shares his absolute passion for sourcing the finest Indiana-grown ingredients and his love for searching for exotic yeast strains as an essential ingredient to craft his exotic flavor profiles. Misty Weisensteiner talks about cool rural destinations and activities in Discover Southern Indiana's 8-county region. Next up, we'll stop in at Jefferson, Indiana, for a visit with City Engineer Andy Crouch, who oversees operations at the Cultural Art District's NoCo Art Center, where we'll also visit with artist Greg Rush, who operates his River Ghost Art Studio in the center. Luann Mattson, Chief Marketing Officer with SoIn Tourism, shares her insights and recommendations for things to do and see around Jeffersonville and nearby activities throughout southern Indiana.
So my name is Alan Bishop, and we are at Spirits of French Lick Distillery in West Baden, Indiana.
And how far from Big City?
Maybe an hour and 10 minutes from Louisville, about 2 hours from Indy, somewhere in there.
So you're day trippable from a lot of different places.
Absolutely. We hope to be anyway.
So are you fairly new operation?
So we started in 2016 is when we started distillation operations. And, of course, we're tied to a family-owned winery. And I think they started that in 95. So, Yeah, overall fairly new. So
you're like a sub-entity under the parent umbrella of the winery.
Yeah, they basically cash flowed the distillery out of the winery is what they did. And it worked really well. And it's a business model that I see working well for wineries and breweries to add a distillery. So,
is there a brewery under this roof?
Unfortunately, we have that weird three-way law in Indiana where you can't have all three.
But, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So you're really, I always joke, you're a brewer that doesn't know when to quit.
Yeah.
Because that's really how you start, right?
Well, that's a joke I always make. You know what beer is? Beer is just whiskey that didn't live up to its potential.
Exactly.
Didn't go the next step.
Yeah, but you go the whole step.
We do. Yeah. We do.
How did you get the bug? You know, what got you?
I grew up in it. I had a family that all came from Kentucky. And, of course, there's a long distillation history here in Indiana, too. But I had
a
family.
So bootlegging was in your
moonshining,
family?
Moonshining and tobacco farming. That was how we paid for everything.
So you understood it. As a kid, I mean, you grew up with it.
Yeah, I was around stills when I was like 3 years old. To me, it was like a tractor. It's another reason why we can't go do something fun on Saturday, right? When I was about 15, then I got tangentially interested, and my grandpa and dad helped me build a little 10-gallon, and they said, don't blow yourself up in the backyard and bring us something that's worth drinking. So
that's so cool. So how did you go to the second level?
got a little too big for my britches in my 20s, and my now wife said, you better go get a job doing this. And mm-hmm. so I made the worst resume that anyone's ever seen, and I took it to every distillery that was opening until somebody finally said yes.
Cool. And were you cellar rat starting out, and what did you do?
No, they hired me on full-time as a distiller at a distillery in Louisville, Kentucky, making brandy. Honestly, I was the only person in the building that had any real hands-on distillation equipment. But, you know, when you go from a 150-gallon up to here's a 1,000-gallon and a 750-gallon and a steam boiler, mm-hmm. you either learn quick or something goes really wrong fast.
What were some of the cool things that you did learn?
Obviously, learning about the boiler, I don't know if I'd call that cool, but that was part of it. But learning how to scale stuff up, right? Because that's scary mm-hmm. when you've only ever doing an absinthe or botanical spirit on a 10-gallon, right? Because you couldn't afford to do it on 150 at home. But then you got to scale it up to a 750-gallon, right? I always say it's like throwing darts at a dartboard when you scale it up. If you're even touching the dartboard, you're doing okay.
You're doing good. That's funny. So you obviously had some successes. You wound up opening your own operation.
Yeah, so, and I don't own anything here. I'm just a head distiller. I call myself head alchemist because I say if you're going to be pretentious, go all the way, right?
But it's kind of, there's a benefit, I think, in a way, in that it allows you to stay focused on what you're good at.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was the thing, you know, being in Louisville, I want to get back over here to what I call the right side of the river. And the main reason for that is because I knew the history here. Mm-hmm. So I saw this as an opportunity. Hey, I know the history and I know how that stuff was made. Let's get into Indiana and bring back the distilling history of Southern Indiana.
Let's go back in time in Indiana, 1820s on. Mm-hmm. What did they make and how did they make it?
Yeah, so apple and peach brandy were always huge because most of the settlers here were from the Black Forest region of Germany. It was almost always double pot distilled. You do see some what they called patent stills, steam stills, and stuff like that. But pretty basic, you know, old school technology, just like you'd see in Scotland or cognac, etc. Very much this idea of represent the fruit as best as what you can. One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that most of the distillers were preacher distillers.
Oh, interesting.
And that's how a lot of the churches here were paid for. Mm-hmm. And they were Campbellite preachers. And they traveled from town to town, and they figured out quickly that liquor was part of the culture, and if they could produce the liquor, they could make money for churches, and they could cut the people off that needed to be cut off.
That's real interesting. There's Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. Origins of Jack was a preacher who taught this guy who taught Jack.
Yeah. Dan Call, Nearest Green, Jack Daniels.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly. Yep. That's so trippy. The other dynamic going back in time, people don't talk about, but you well know, is one of the reasons why you drank whiskey is because if you drank the water, you died.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, people don't think about this either, but alcohol, whether it be whiskey, brandy, whatever base alcohol you're making, it was a hard scrabble life. Wherever you were in the 1800s, all the way, well, I mean, even now, things are still not always easy, but not like it was then. You had to have something that you could dissolve different types of botanicals into for different medicinal uses, etc. Mm-hmm. And even if you didn't have that, you had to have something that would just kind of take the edge off of your day.
So it really was a pharmacopoeia. It really was medicine. It was your pharmacy. It was the best hope you had.
Well, and around here, if you go back into the history books, until the late 1840s, it was considered rude not to have a bottle of whiskey on your table. If you're having a neighbor over to help with with a corn shucking bee or putting up a building, you better have whiskey on that table. Mm-hmm. It was just part of it.
But it literally was one of the four food groups in that sense.
Absolutely, yes. Yep.
And again, to reiterate, you couldn't drink the water.
Yep, absolutely. Well, and that brings up another interesting point, too. You know, people don't think about, but distilling is inherently an agricultural pursuit, right? And we live in a day of commodities, but, you know, there's a little different back then. It was still kind of commodity stuff, but not like we do it now, mm-hmm. right? It was a labor of love, but it was also a way to preserve your harvest and very much so related to your farm and what you could grow or what you could get locally.
And that being said, to this day, you rely on raw ag ingredients, apples, for example. Mm-hmm. Give us some other examples of the raw agricultural products.
Obviously, corn is a big thing. And for years, Indiana was sending, you know, its corn into Kentucky to make bourbon. So why shouldn't we just make it here to some degree? And we're happy to have Kentucky's business, don't get me wrong.
And like you said, you're right across the border.
Yeah.
So from a terroir standpoint.
Yeah. It's everything.
No.
You always joke that it's the wrong side of the Magic River, right? As though everyone in Kentucky got to the southern bank, they looked across at the northern side of the river, and they said, I don't know what's over there, but I'm not going.
That's funny.
But rye as well, wheat, barley, etc. You know, we try to get as much stuff locally as we can. We try to grow as much as we can. You know, we can't grow all of it, but we do try to grow about 30 acres of corn. We have a very genetically diverse open pollinated corn that we grow. We grow about 30 acres of wheat every year. We do buy from a local maltster, at least somewhat local. He's up in around Indianapolis, Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Oh, within the state.
Yep, and family owned, and you know, doing it all on his dad's farm. So
that's really cool. Another area that fascinates me in your world, it's a nuance, but it makes a game changer in flavor profile, and that's the world of yeast. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say is that a lot of commodity distillers, they'll tell you that the yeast doesn't matter. They'll tell you the grain doesn't matter. You know, corn is corn, right? Yeast is right. Yeast, and I am not a believer in that at all. Mm-hmm. So I've been interested in yeast for a very, very long time. You know, growing up, it was obviously, you know, bread yeast. That's sure. What you use.
Well, you talked about the history of Fleischmann's.
Yeah.
Mention that for a moment.
They were distillers before they ever got into the yeast business. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with, I see home distillers say all the time, oh, you shouldn't use Fleischmann's for, you know, distilling. I'm like, why wouldn't you?
Right.
It makes good bread. It's going to, you know, bread and whiskey are not that far off. It's going to make good whiskey as long as it finishes the fermentation and it tastes good. Run with it. But I'm interested in yeast in the same way that I was interested in heirloom grains, right? Nobody was talking heirloom grains and whiskey, you know, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But again, distilling is inherently agricultural. So if you have all these odd corns, you have all these odd ryes, these heirloom corns, this is all tied to the locavore movement, etc. Why wouldn't you see what they do in a whiskey? The same thing with the yeast, right? We all want to talk about what pre-prohibition whiskey was like, and we'll talk about everything else except for the yeast strain. You know, so I've made it a point here in southern Indiana, in what we call the Black Forest region of southern Indiana, to go to some of these old distilleries that were out there and try to propagate yeast from the existing equipment that's still out there.
Wow, so you're scraping the walls.
Yeah, we're scraping the walls. We're setting, you know, yeast traps. I'm geeky, man. I got a refrigerator full of yeast at home, and my wife is about tired of it.
She needs to buy your refrigerator on the garage.
Well, here's the problem. So I've got one in the basement, and it's full already, and then I have to have backup samples in everybody else's refrigerator.
Right. I love it. A little deeper on how you can manipulate and tweak the flavor profile just through the yeast.
Just through the yeast itself, yeah. So the main thing is that you're going to have different yeasts that are intended maybe for different things, but I'll give you a couple examples. So Fleischmann's, for example, is really good at pulling out those bread sort of aromas, those grain aromas, those big fresh baked bread aromas. If you switch out to, say, a brandy yeast, a commercial brandy yeast, and it may not be as well attenuated as some of the other yeasts are for whiskey, but now you're able to pull out these fruity esters, these fruity profiles that you might not ordinarily get in whiskey. Another one that I love playing with, and it's actually multiple strains, but it's called Kvike. And I'm probably not saying that right because my Hoosier accent comes through.
Right.
But Kvike is an old Norwegian or Scandinavian farm brewer's yeast.
Uh-huh.
And they would actually propagate this yeast with their beer and their... I'm trying to think of the word for it, it's where they were doing their malt kilning. So it would get really hot in there. It'd be 110 degrees. So this yeast will operate at 110 degrees.
Wow.
It'll knock out a fermentation in 24 hours, and it's fruity and it's funky and it's like strawberry and guava and all these odd characteristics that you would never get from anything else. Or one of the yeast strains that we pulled from here in Indiana from Spring Mill. It gives a Ceylon cinnamon, very heavy cinnamon toast crunch aroma that you can't get from any other yeast out there.
So with that palette that you operate from, you can anticipate and be pretty confident what you're going to wind up with 4 years later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's I call them flavor bridges. So you look at things, that's a good one.
So it's only a case.
Right. Welcome to the distillery. So, yeah, you look at things like flavor bridges, for example. So if you were doing a botanical spirit, if you wanted a cinnamon flavor to it, you might take both cinnamon and Ceylon cinnamon and add a little bit of cayenne pepper.
Wow.
So if you start thinking about, all right, you have a yeast that already gives you some Ceylon cinnamon, and you have a grain bill that has some spiciness to it, but also has some sweetness from some oats or from some wheat, well, now you can produce a snickerdoodle cookie in a bottle. Right?
That's incredible.
So,
and now talk about corn for a moment.
So corn is obviously the basis of bourbon, and bourbon, a lot of people don't realize it, but at base, bourbon is a corn whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
That's its primary component. It has to be 51% corn. And we're just now at a point, luckily, where there are other distillers talking about the diversity of corn, and that's important, A, from a genetic diversity standpoint, but also, B, from a flavor perspective. So you look at all these different colored corns, and are they pretty? Yeah. Do they have interesting histories and stories? Yeah. That's all marketable stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But those colors are long-chain amino acids, and they're either going to be water-soluble or fat-soluble. So in pot still distillation, their aromatic precursors are going to come across. You're going to get these unique aromas, these unique flavors that are more phenolic in nature. So you'll get things like an aromatic precursor from anthocyanin, which is almost like the flavor that you would get from like a blackberry seed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That comes through, kind of black cherry, etc. Carotenoids, which are very dark orange. You know, we've got a corn in particular that's almost the color of a pumpkin. Those tend to come off super buttery, super round. They make the best grits in the world. If they make good grits, they're going to make good whiskey. Everything mm-hmm. I do is basically me just taking food and making it into whiskey.
So. Well, that being said, at the end, you have your whiskey, but then for that to properly show itself off, you need to pair it with food.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
So it would follow that you would do some, like, tasting dinners.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's a matter of finding those interesting contrasts, right? Flavor is about contrast as much as anything else. So, you know, you guys had a whiskey here earlier today that we call the Morning Glory, and it has this weird Reese's Pieces peanut butter chocolate thing, and it's almost literally, you could classify it as a dessert whiskey. It could literally be in place of a dessert, or maybe you serve it with some ice cream, right? That's the stuff that makes life worth living, is being able to do stuff like that. So,
and your label name is
Spirits of French Lick. That is the distillery name, and then all the various labels are named after different historic places here in Southern Indiana
and outside of the Midwest. Could somebody order your whiskey online?
Yeah, so Sealbox.com, I think, ships to 33 states, roughly. We're looking at a couple of other online retailers, and we're hoping that in the next couple of years, Indiana is going to open up shipping. You know, recently, Kentucky did that. I think Indiana's seeing that they're missing out on some revenue, and that's the important part, is get them to recognize the revenue they're missing out on.
Temptation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, to learn more about your world,
you can find me at spiritsoffrenchlick.com, and then also thealchemistcabinet.com, which is where I do a lot of writing about whiskey history here in Indiana, etc. I do a lot of consulting work, things of that nature.
And I heard you're a podcaster.
I am. So I run a Distillers Talk podcast, which you can find on any podcast platform. Not the best audio quality in the world, but we're working on that.
There you go.
And if you have Ghost, You Have Everything podcast, which is very much a paranormal sort of leaning, somewhat tying whiskey and mm-hmm. distillation into the spiritual world. So
love it.
My name is Alan Bishop. I'm head distiller at Spirits of French Lick.
Alan, thank you so much. What a wonderful morning.
Man. Absolutely.
It's been great.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
All right. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Southern Indiana. We'll see you here.
My name is Misty Weisensteiner, Discover Southern Indiana.
Here we are overlooking a pretty cool river with commercial navigable river.
It is. There's barges that go up and down. We're at the Overlook Restaurant in Southern Indiana in Crawford County, Leavenworth.
The Ohio River?
Yeah, it's the Ohio River. Yeah, so we're looking right across the river to Kentucky, actually.
Oh, wow. So we need a hall pass to go over there?
I don't think so. But there's no bridges close to us here.
No, there aren't. So again, where are we in the county, in the nearest town?
We are in Leavenworth, which is in Crawford County, which is a part of the Discover Southern Indiana region, which is what I represent. Mm-hmm. And it covers 8 counties, kind of in the southern central portion of the state.
Tell us a little bit more about the areas that you cover. They're all rural for the most part, aren't they?
Very rural, but lots of different diverse things to offer people to do. You know, you could easily spend a whole week in the area. There's great history, resort hotels, 4-star, 4-diamond. You know, there's lots of outdoor recreation, world-class caves that you can explore, lots of water activities. I mean, you name it, you could probably find it here. Such a beautiful landscape here with the rolling hills and the dense forests.
So what other surprises are here?
We have some wonderful state parks. We have state reservoirs with Patoka Lake, Spring Mill. Hoosier National Forest is here too. So lots of great camping opportunities, mountain biking, hiking. I think that's one of the main things that weaves all of the counties together is the outdoor recreation.
I was with a couple people that took off today to go kayaking. I was jealous of that one.
Yeah, we have kayaking along the Blue River, several several outdoor outfitters that can help you out and get you situated, you know, in what you're looking to do, whether it be kayaking or experience the natural waterways.
Is this a recommended biking destination?
I would say so. There are several mountain biking paths, trails in the community and in southern Indiana in general.
Like you said, you have some cool off-road biking trails.
Yes, absolutely.
Another must-do, say I was coming here and this was my only destination, what would be your 1, 2, 3 of things to do and see?
Oh, man, you're putting me on the spot.
I know. But you know your territory.
I do.
What's the first thing comes to your mind?
Well, obviously the French Lick Resort, because that is such a unique thing, not only to southern Indiana, but I think really the Midwest as a whole. You know, the cave systems that we have Marengo Cave and then several others in the area. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't experience the cave, so I would definitely say that's a must. And then we have some great wineries, too. Patoka Lake Winery, French Lick Winery, you know, the settings and the wines that they have is just, they're wonderful choices.
And you have a couple distilleries too, right?
Yes, the French Lick Winery has a distillery there, and their spirits have won lots of awards. French Lick Spirits is the name of that. But yeah, their spirits are top notch.
Okay, to learn more about your world,
it's discoversouthernindiana.com is the website. Our handles are discoversoin for Instagram, and then Discover Southern Indiana on Facebook. And my name is Misty Weisensteiner.
Awesome, Misty. Have you gone TikTok yet?
Not yet.
Probably going to have to.
I'm a little scared there. It may not be me. I'll find somebody else to do it.
My name is Andy Crouch. I'm the city engineer for the city of Jeffersonville. Kind of oversee as well the public art program, which is a little bit odd, but it's the way it's worked out here. It's a little bit
unique.
Different. It just kind of happened that way. We put public art in public places, and public places is kind of my realm. It's worked out really well. It's been that way for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years now. And we're sitting here in the NOCO Art Center in the heart of our arts district.
And this was an auto body shop?
This was an auto body shop. So somewhere around 12 years or so ago, during a previous mayor's term, different administration, there was a thought of running a canal down the center of downtown Jeffersonville in order to solve some of our combined sewage problems. That mayor started purchasing some properties in order to make that happen. And then there was an election and he got beat. And the new mayor came in and said, we're not going to do that. We're going to change plans and go a different route with it. So that left us with some buildings and the properties that we said, well, okay, great. Well, now what are we going to do with those? Mm-hmm. And we turned this building here, which was an auto body shop, into a community art making space. Across the street was also part of their auto body shop, and we've turned that into a maker space. We have a kind of a artsy type venue right next door to that, where they have a stage, they have bar, they have artist booths, some places for food trucks to come in and just kind of make it a little small party atmosphere.
The city works as an incubator stimulus by providing very affordable costs for the artists, etc., to be here.
Right. We have a number of studios here in our art center. We provide very, very low cost monthly rent for
$50
like
a
50,
month.
75 bucks a month for artists to come in here. And these are typically artists that have been working out of their home. They've been working out of their garage and they really need a little place to spread their wings and expand a little bit and get away from the distractions of home.
And the wives and husbands.
Exactly.
Like that,
exactly. Too. Gets away from the distractions and they can come in. They have 24-hour access. We have some artists that are in here at 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning working, and then I've noticed there's some that come through at 2 o'clock in the morning
wow.
and work till sunrise.
Vampires.
So, yeah, exactly. And, you know, it kind of depends on, for a lot of them, this is a second job. Mm-hmm. So it depends on when their other job is and what family requirements are, so they get in here and work when they can.
And how about public engagement? Do you have public that come in here to visit the artists or buy their works, or do they pretty much go to shows?
We have shows here regularly or across the street at the depot. These artists that are here in the studio get tapped quite a bit to go and do shows when we're having public events there. And then they go and do shows on their own. You know, there's always a public art show pretty much every weekend from spring through fall. So they're going out to other shows. They, you know, they're creating their products and their art here and then going out to other shows and selling them there.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's great.
Anything you want to add? Secrets you're holding back? about the operation?
We don't really have a lot of secrets here. We're working to make this more accessible. Right now, the Art Center isn't open during the day to the public, but we have a plan in place probably for next year to make this really function more like a library that could be. You could come in and select something off a shelf that's an art project and find a space, sit down and work with you or your family and do some art for an hour or a few hours.
Well, I could see part of it being a little gallery space. That
we
would
have,
be cool.
Yeah, the walls that you see, the black and white walls that you see kind of sitting around the perimeter, they're all on wheels. So we can move all those around anytime we need to, and we turn those into gallery wall spaces, or we can segment some of the areas off. And
so you can expandable, contractible.
Exactly. Yeah. It's nice having this big open space because we can change it up into what we need for the time.
You could even have a big sit-down dinner event.
We could. We just had a breakfast meeting in here for about 40 or 45 people this morning, and now we'll convert it for a different event starting next week.
That's really cool. To learn more about your world, give us a website.
Sure. It's jeffersonvilleart.com, and my name is Andy Crouch.
Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
This has been great. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Southern Indiana.
Hi, my name is Greg Rush. I'm an artist at the NoCo Art Center in Jeffersonville, Indiana. My studio goes by the name of River Ghost Art.
And this is a nonprofit, right? This is a...
It's city-owned.
Okay.
So nonprofits use the center. It's always available to them. Very community-focused, events going on all the time.
They rent out artist workshop spaces, and you have one of those.
Yeah, we have eight studios available for rent here, ranging from about a 200-foot studio to the biggest one's probably about 600 to 800 square feet.
Wow. And there's a real breadth of artists that specialize in different stuff. You love wood.
Right.
Tell us about what you do briefly.
I do woodwork primarily, everything from furniture pieces to sculptural pieces and wall art. A lot of what I try to do is incorporating varieties of wood that most people would be throwing away. Mm-hmm. I use... So
it's recycled, reused?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Old furniture that I'll take and reclaim. And then also the natural wood I use is what people would consider junk wood, because I go down to the river and I pull out the driftwood and old stumps and things, and then I incorporate the two together. I'll take a furniture piece that somebody threw away that has a couple of broken legs, and I'll replace those legs with tree limbs and really try to integrate the different mediums and styles together.
And do you go to like art fairs and places to show your work?
Yeah, most of what I do is local. We have art shows actually here at the Art Center. We usually do about 4 big shows a year here. So, yeah, I'm always out there trying to sell it, or you can just look me up online.
Do you have a website?
On Facebook, under River Ghost Art.
There you go.
You can find me.
Okay. TikTok, Instagram.
I'm on Instagram and Facebook right now. Have not evolved up to TikTok yet.
Everybody's going there.
I know.
It's crazy.
Snapchat, all of those. I haven't got there yet. And my name is Greg Rush.
Greg, thank you so much.
I'm Lou Anne Mattson. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer for Sew In Tourism. And Sew In is Southern Indiana. Sew In is our part of Southern Indiana. That's Clark and Floyd counties, just across the Ohio River from Louisville, Kentucky.
Which you can see.
Yeah, you can see it from here. In fact, I can look out my office window and see Louisville.
That's really cool. Different state.
Different state, but we're part of the Louisville metro area. My dad worked in Louisville for 38 years.
Wow.
I had a grandmother in Louisville and one in Indiana, so came back and forth. Then people in Louisville come over to visit Southern Indiana all the time.
So again, we're on the other side of the river,
uh-huh.
And it is a very different world, even though you can see high rises on the horizon, close horizon. We're in a small town.
Yeah, right now we're in Jeffersonville, and that's about 50,000 people. Clarksville is just to the west of us. New Albany is west of that, all along the Ohio River. And then if you go east from here, there's Charlestown. And then if you go inland, there's Borden and Starlight, which is where Huber's Orchard and Winery is, and Joe Huber's Family Farm and Restaurant, Sellersburg, and a lot of great little communities.
What would be a recommended reason to come here and destinations, places to see and do?
Well, you know, we say that Soin is in the sweet spot. We're not city like the high rises, but we're not country either. We're right in that sweet spot. We've got these great walkable downtowns with lots of great shops in Jeffersonville and New Albany. On the culinary scene, we get a lot of people from Louisville who want to open up their restaurants here. And we have a really dynamic culinary scene with a lot of great stuff. Cocktail scene is wonderful.
From a business standpoint, startup, the economic opportunity be more approachable here, cost of real estate, etc.
Yes.
So that'd be a reason why they would come start up here.
Yep. You know, for a while there, I really felt like New Albany and Jeffersonville were like these proving grounds for restaurants. So they would come over there. There was a barbecue restaurant that started off in New Albany, and then they graduated, you know, went over to the Louisville area.
Yeah.
And Ryan Rogers was the proprietor there, and he was, you know, Eater magazine. He was like one of their young guns that they profiled back in the mid-2010s.
So that's cool. So over here in town and around, you guys get the benefit of having these little startup proving ground.
Yep.
Eateries where you get some really fascinating dinner options, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then even a business that started a few years ago called Mesa, a live dining show, and all these local chefs that do these great things, they invite them in and they can sit around. It's almost like a bar. You can sit around the bar. You know how you sit at a bar and talk to the bartender?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this, it's a kitchen. And the person across the bar from you is a chef.
Oh, how
and
funny.
That chef is
they're actually preparing
doing a
stuff?
Three-course meal,
wow.
Yep, telling you about what they're preparing, why they're using certain ingredients. The people love it because they can see their food being made or born, whatever.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But the chefs love it too because, you know, a chef, they want to share their food. They want to make things for people.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to see that right there. Because
they get the reaction too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, a little bit more. We've covered food, a little taste of. And I'm here at the Art Center.
Right.
Just interviewed an artist.
Yep.
So another dimension, you talked about distilleries and that whole world.
Yep. So the Starlight Distillery is owned by Huber's Orchard Winery and Vineyards. It's a family farm. They've been here since the 1800s.
Oh.
They celebrated 175 years. They're on 600 acres. They do a U-pick operation. They source a lot of the grains and things from their place and then make it right on site.
They're
wine, Indiana's largest estate bottled vineyard.
Wow. How about cider? Do they do apple cider?
They do apple cider. I don't know that they do hard cider. Mm-hmm. Now you're testing me on.
Well, if you buy their cider and you let it hang out for a
while.
There
you go. You can make your own cider.
Yeah.
But yeah, we love Huber's apple cider.
That's so cool. Are we going to go there?
You are tonight, this afternoon.
I'm ready.
Yeah. Do a tasting.
Yeah.
And they've got a great farm market. They've got the Starlight Cafe. So there's all kinds of great things that you can do there. In the fall, which is, you know, it's October right now.
Mm-hmm.
They have five times the amount of people on the weekends there that they normally do because everybody goes up there and picks pumpkins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a fantastic time to be up there.
Do they have the mandatory kid maze? Sometimes they do the little...
Nearby at Joe Huber's family farm, they have a corn maze, and that's free for families on the weekends.
Could lose your kid there.
You could, but we'll look for him.
Yeah. So one more must-see in your world.
Well, it's hard to choose. So the river, you know, we have the Ohio River right next to us.
I saw, like,
I think
steamboat
there. There's a tie. I was going to give you a tie between the Falls of the Ohio, which is a fossil bed that you can walk out onto when the river levels are low.
That's cool.
And then you can go learn about the steamboat history. The Howard Steamboat Museum talks about the steamboat era. And the Belle of Louisville is the only steamboat in America that reached the age of 100.
Wow.
And this month she's celebrating her 108th birthday.
And it still goes out?
It still goes out,
wow,
yeah. So you can go on the Ohio River and you can look at Louisville, you can look at southern Indiana.
So they just do day trips then?
Yes, yes. And so they've got the McAlpin locks and dams are right over here. Sometimes they do locks cruises. They're having a fall foliage cruise here at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. And they tell so many great historical facts on the Belle of Louisville. So it's really fun.
That's really cool. Does the river ever freeze over?
It used to, but I don't know that it gets icy, mm-hmm. but I don't know that it really freezes over. There's a lot of commerce on the mm-hmm. Ohio River.
Right. So they probably would get yeah. icebreakers out of it.
Yeah, but there's a part of the Ohio River that's protected over on the Indiana side, mm-hmm. and there's a two-mile stretch that is non-commercial. It's the only two-mile stretch that's non-commercial.
Oh, interesting.
So, and you see a lot of people going down there with kayaks.
I was going to say, it must be a real popular kayak yep, place. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Okay, to learn more about your world.
So you can go to gosoin.com. That's GOSOIN.com. Okay. And that has all the information about what to do in Southern Indiana. And my name is Lou Ann Mattson, and I'm with So In Tourism.
Awesome. Well, I am so in Southern Indiana.
So in love with Southern Indiana.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst. From swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean, these experiences are unparalleled in their historical relevance and grandeur. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to preserve the past to inspire future generations of dreamers. This is accomplished through the youth education program focused on deserving junior high students across California. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, one of the most awe-inspiring locations in the world. The legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture, is woven into the foundation at Hearst Castle's mission. Julia Morgan's life can continue to inspire and empower young women and young men all over the world. This is one of the few opportunities to donate to such an important cause that not only changes the lives and perspectives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors. Please go to the website, foundation@hearstcastle.com, to learn more about how you can help us with our important mission.